This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
They've managed to undermine trust to such an extent that you have a big part of your population now, you know, really unable to figure out who they can trust, what to believe, and they are left, I think, at the mercy of their own kind of tribal animosities and of politicians who appeal to them.
The next time you hear the White House assert that up is down and down is up, consider what paved the way for this template of mendacity. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak with environmental attorney and author Barbara Fries about her new book, Industrial Strength Denial. Fries takes us on a historical tour of the havoc that big business has wreaked on the planet and on truth itself. We discuss the climate change denial movement and how it relates to the Trump administration's handling of the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the pernicious legacy of leaded gasoline. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Barbara Fries. She is an environmental attorney and author, and her new book, which just came out, is entitled Industrial Strength Denial. Barbara, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
It's a wide-ranging palette that you work with. You've kind of broken it down into some of the more egregious areas of corporate crime in the environmental space. Your first book was about coal, A Human History, and we can kind of put coal a little bit in our rearview mirror, I believe, and you've done that in this book. Why don't you talk about what inspired you to write this?
Sure. Well, it actually started with the same legal proceeding that inspired me to write about coal several years ago. I was an assistant attorney general in the state of Minnesota, and I was involved in implementing our environmental laws. And we had this proceeding there. It was an energy planning proceeding, and we were trying to understand the environmental impact of generating power, and that meant of burning coal. And the coal industry came to Minnesota to explain to us that, among other things, we really did not need to worry about climate change because it wasn't going to happen, or because if it did happen, we were going to like it. And all of those scientists who were already warning about this and whose work had been the basis of a global treaty on climate change, all those scientists were biased, and it would be okay if we ignored them. So that kind of got my attention, and I wrote this book about coal then, following that proceeding. And after that, I did other work as an environmental attorney and trying to prevent the construction of new coal plants and trying to get climate laws in place. And I kept seeing this climate denial that I had originally heard from the industry, but that was spreading through society, through right-wing media, and eventually would take over the Republican Party and then the federal government. So to get to my new book, Industrial Strength Denial, you know, as I listened to this denial and watched it spread, I started viewing it as a social phenomenon. I think it's the only way you can understand this. And once you start seeing it like that, well, you have to ask, what has this social phenomenon done to us in the past? How have other industries reacted to evidence that they were causing harm? What exactly did they say in terms of their denials and their rationalizations? And how much damage did they do? And how did society overcome that denial, if it did? And so then I started doing the research and came up with these 8 different campaigns of denial that I thought were just particularly interesting, particularly revealing, and profoundly destructive.
Yes, why don't you kind of give us an overview of the different chapters, and then Sure. We can focus on one or two.
Okay, sounds good. So the first chapter is actually about the British slave trade. And I went back that far I was a little concerned because I certainly don't want to suggest a moral equivalence between selling people and the other commercial activities I talk about. But there was a very organized abolition movement in Britain, which in the late 1700s dominated the world slave trade. And that abolition movement sparked a very organized campaign from the slave lobby, both the traders and the sugar plantation owners in the West Indies. They organized, they wrote these pamphlets, so we have this all in writing, defending their trade, and it became, I thought, such an important illustration of what a lucrative industry is capable of rationalizing that I began there. Then I moved up to the radium industry in the early 20th century in the U.S., which was briefly basically marketed as a consumer product and as a cure-all, so people were consuming radium. Then I move on to the auto industry and its reluctance to take any responsibility to make cars safer when they crash. I go into leaded gasoline and the denials around ozone depletion. Then, of course, I have to talk about the tobacco industry, which raised denial to a really new art form. Then I take kind of a sidetrack and look at the financial services industry and Wall Street and how it denied the risks of the products that led to the financial crisis of 2008. And then I end with climate denial by the fossil fuel industry, which is, of course, how I got started.
So let's focus on this last chapter first. It's entitled A Deceitful, Hysterical, Out of Control Rampage. First, why don't you give that quote some context?
Sure. That quote is a description of the climate warnings by the president of a coal company. And he basically was accusing all of those who are worried about climate change, from the scientists to the government to the activists, everybody, of, well, as you said, a deceitful, hysterical, out of control rampage. And I thought it was just a particularly wonderful quote because this particular coal magnate was kind of summarizing all kinds of projection. I mean, one of the things that we see particularly from the fossil fuel industry and particularly around climate denial is the industry accusing its critics of that which it is much more legitimately accused of itself. So it will talk about the global warming industry and how people raising alarm are in fact motivated by greed. If they're scientists, they just want grants. If they're journalists, they just want to sell books or newspapers. They will accuse those concerned of perpetrating a big hoax and of deceit. Well, of course, we know that there's a lot of deceit coming from the industry. They'll accuse the industry of, or they'll accuse the global warming people who are concerned of being alarmists, of being fear mongers, of other things. So I just really liked that particular quote. He was testifying before Congress at the time, so it's not like he was just muttering some aside.
And you were on the front line of very early climate change litigation in 1995. Why don't you give us kind of a background on this case that you argued in Minnesota?
Sure. This was, as I mentioned, an energy planning proceeding. So it's not like we were suing somebody for damages or something. We just wanted in Minnesota to have an idea of what kind of damage we were doing to the environment when we generated electricity. And of course, electricity is an industry heavily regulated. It's utilities, and they're governed by a public utilities commission. And so it's important for that commission to know when it approves rates or approves investments if it's good for the public interest. So that's sort of how we got into it. And it was still pretty early in the debate about climate change, at least on the state level, so that when we started looking at climate change, we really struck a nerve with the coal industry. And they sent lots of witnesses to Minnesota to testify. And as I mentioned, they gave us a very different perspective on what the problem was and whether or not we should factor it in our energy decisions. And I can say that I think they pretty completely lost the case when it came to the science. That is, the judge hearing the case and the commission that then approved the issue really did not accept their view of the science. Instead, they accepted the mainstream view of the science as set forth by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in their official findings. But I think what the industry succeeded in doing was raising enough doubt about the issue that the judge recommended and the commission accepted a very high discount rate. So they were basically saying, yeah, this looks like a real thing, but we're not going to give too high a value to future costs because we're not really sure they're going to happen. So what that meant was we ended up with a numeric value for the costs of climate change that was very low and didn't really make that much difference in terms of future energy decisions.
Yes, and then you conclude that case by saying, you know, this was nothing compared to what I was about to see in the years ahead. And let me just quote from the book. You say, over the years, climate denial would become increasingly tribal, ideological, toxic, and detached from both empirical reality and prior norms of civility. I like that. And it's the harsh reality of where we are today. So maybe square what you learned in 1995 with what you learned in researching this chapter for this 2020 release.
Sure. Well, one thing to understand is that there are lots of different aspects to what I'll call the fossil fuel industry. And this chapter also goes beyond just the companies selling fossil fuels and includes the groups that they have funded. Because, of course, one of the things that lots of industries have done, from the slave lobby to tobacco, is to channel their messages through front groups. And the fossil fuel industry certainly did that. They would set up different groups. They would fund anti-regulatory groups. And those groups then tended to be way more aggressive and toxic in terms of attacking other people and suggesting that climate change is just a big hoax. So that's really how things became, I think, much more brutal in the years that followed. And then also you would see the right-wing media carrying some of these accusations into the larger public and spreading them. So, you know, you're at the point now where the oil industry, and we haven't talked much about the oil industry, they spent years and years raising doubts about the climate science and funding groups that really perpetuated those doubts. But now the oil majors don't deny that we're causing global warming and we have to do something about it. And many of them would say that they support the goals of the Paris Agreement. But they are still trying to expand their investments, expand their sales. So there's a serious disconnect there. The coal industry, meanwhile, still remains pretty strict in its denial that this is a problem. You even have them claiming that climate change is a good thing, that putting more CO2 into the atmosphere is good for the plants, and that's going to be good for all the world, kind of a new Eden. This argument's actually been around for a while, but it's continuing to be spouted. But, you know, and part of what we've seen now is the denial from that industry taking a very populist tone, so that, you know, in addition to just saying, no, the science, you know, is uncertain or the science is wrong and climate change is a good thing, they're basically attacking and part of a broader attack on the credibility of science and scientific establishments and institutions, of government, of journalism, certainly, of academia, all of these groups falling under the larger title of the elite. So, you know, you can see how this kind of feeds into our political divides today and to our kind of post-truth era, because they've managed to undermine trust to such an extent that you have a big part of your population now, you know, really unable to figure out who they can trust, what to believe, and they are left, I think, at the mercy of their own kind of tribal animosities and of politicians who appeal to them.
Well, I know what's right. I got just one life. in a world that keeps on pushing me around. But I stand my ground and I won't back down. Hey, baby, there ain't no easy way out. Hey, I will stand my ground and I won't back down. No, I won't back down.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental attorney and author Barbara Fries. Her new book is Industrial Strength Denial. So Barbara, in this climate change denial chapter, you have a little section about the hoax. And reading it, I couldn't help but draw a lot of parallels with what we're seeing right now from the Trump administration speaking about this pandemic as a hoax. Mm-hmm. What lessons did you learn in researching the climate denialism hoax, the both-sidisms, and trying to get away from science and just putting a needle of doubt in a haystack of of reality into what we're seeing unfold right now during this global health crisis?
Well, first of all, I think you're right. The parallels are very clear, and the accusations that any piece of information you don't like is a hoax is exactly parallel. And of course, we see that not just with COVID and not just with climate, but with, you know, the Russia investigation, Ukraine, everything like that.
And tobacco.
And certainly tobacco, right. I mean, the fingerprints of various industries on this general anti-science perspective, they're all over the place. As far as lessons, boy, you know, it's just so hard to draw lessons yet from the climate chapter because we haven't solved the climate problem yet.
Maybe not lessons, but like more insight than what we're hearing from turning on the news or reading an article.
Yeah.
You know, I just saw Eric Trump saying that this whole pandemic thing will just magically disappear after the election because this is just some Democrat hoax.
Yeah.
It's somehow everything has become red team versus blue team.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That was that template was created in the climate denial movement in many ways.
Yes, I think that's right. And of course, the climate denial movement was building on tobacco and other industries. Tobacco, I think, really did a lot to launch the sort of attack on government science. And I guess one thing I point out, and this applies to COVID and climate and tobacco and all of them, is that when they criticize the government science or the scientific authorities, they don't really need to do much more than raise doubt. They don't need to persuade people that they're right. They don't need to persuade people to trust the industry or to trust them. They just need to introduce doubt, because doubt creates paralysis. And when you have that, you basically block government action. And if you are on the side that does not want government action, it's pretty easy to see what you should do. And for those of us who want government to do things to help solve our problems, we have a big hurdle to overcome.
And it's a self-perpetuating message. When the government fails, we can just say, well, see, that's why you don't want government involved.
Right, exactly. I mean, imagine if you were trying to hire somebody to run your corporation and you put in charge somebody who didn't believe in the fundamental mission of the corporation and therefore kept screwing it up. I mean, it is a strange and self-perpetuating situation to put in charge of our government people who don't really believe very much in governing.
No. And when we think of not only the fear-mongering of big government, it's also the idea of asking our citizens to make some kind of sacrifice, maybe driving a huge gas guzzler that's going to hold everything that you ever owned that you may drive around once in a while. These small but important sacrifices that we haven't really been able to make Americans as a whole buy into, similar to what we're seeing in terms of just like wearing a protective mask around. We're seeing this backlash, and I don't want to be infringed on my First Amendment rights. It's taken this whole freedom thing to a degree that we're not part of this whole social contract.
Right. Well, you know, we have always focused in this country very much on freedom, and that makes sense, and on our individual rights. We have not focused very much on responsibility toward each other and toward society generally. And so that becomes a barrier when you're dealing with any of these issues, but certainly climate change and certainly COVID. Though, you know, there's one thing I would like to point out that gives me a little bit of hope in this situation. And that is that over the last couple of months, Americans really have done quite a lot in terms of changing their lives and putting their businesses on hold, and many, many people losing their incomes, not to mention getting sick. But people have done a fair bit. Now, obviously, there are protests, and that is starting to unravel. But a lot of it has happened. And my understanding is that the opinion polls are still really quite supportive of most of these restrictions, and more people are concerned about opening up the economy too quickly than about keeping it closed down. And that gives me some hope that, you know, these larger percentages of Americans are not just buying hook, line, and sinker, the notion that this is some kind of a hoax just meant to improve government tyranny or to reduce Trump's chances of reelection.
I think that's an important thing to keep in mind. We can't help but look at the train wreck unfolding sometimes when you see, you know, somebody who's being rude to somebody for no reason, or a crowded restaurant where people are just flouting regulations. But it's a sliver, a very small sliver, but it gets our dander up, so to speak. And in a clickbait world on the internet, it could seem like a significant portion of the population. And I think it's similar in terms of climate change. I think the climate change denial movement, whether we, obviously it set us back, but if you look at polling, the vast majority of Americans believe that climate change is real now.
Yes, that's right. And that's a really good sign. And another thing to keep in mind is that even while the federal government has been completely paralyzed on this issue, we have had lots of states and lots of localities and businesses, but let's talk about the states and localities, moving forward now and not just now, but moving forward over the years, putting in place laws that promote clean energy, that reduce carbon emissions. And it's one of those situations where, you know, I often found myself over the years thanking God that we had a federal system, and that dysfunction at the very top did not prevent action at the state level. Not all states, obviously, but many of them. And I think you have to say the same thing about COVID, that even if we don't have management from the federal government, we at least do have it in many, many states where it's being taken very seriously and where governors and others are making data-driven decisions.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to environmental attorney and author Barbara Fries. So Barbara, you also have a chapter you mentioned in your new book, Industrial Strength Denial, about leaded gasoline. It's a topic that I've always found fascinating. We had Kevin Drum on maybe almost a decade ago from Mother Jones, who cited some research about crime and lead in our gas. And why don't you first explain to our listeners the history a little bit behind leaded gasoline? As a kid, I always assumed that gasoline naturally had lead in it, but that now this great new innovation allowed us to have unleaded gasoline. But that wasn't the case, was it?
As if unleaded was decaffeinated or something, right?
Exactly. Yeah, they've taken out the lead. Great news. But
yeah, exactly.
Explain the history of it with DuPont and General Motors, if you can.
Right. Well, General Motors was dealing with this problem in the 1920s where automobile engines had a knock. They didn't perform very well. They did some sort of coughing as they tried to go, and especially as they tried to make those engines more powerful. So they experimented with various ways to change the fuel, and they figured out that if you added a little bit of lead, a particular chemical that includes lead, you could get rid of the knock. But lead was known then, it was conspicuous then, as an environmental toxin and a workplace toxin. People had known that since antiquity, that lead affects the brain. So there's this little letter that the Surgeon General sends to GM, and I'll paraphrase, but it was kind of this tentative, gee, you know, lead, we know it's cumulative and it builds up and then it affects the mind. Is this really such a good idea to be introducing it into the nation's fuel supply? And the GM engineer who had come up with this basically wrote back and said, well, we don't really have any evidence on this point, but we don't think it'll be detectable. Kind of a, you know, what you can't see can't hurt you.
Famous last words, right?
Famous last words. And the thing is, this wasn't being done secretly. It sort of was being done secretly, but the secret got out. And the various public health authorities were very alarmed. This ended up in the newspapers. And they were saying, look, this builds up. It's going to accumulate, and you could be in a position where all the cars require leaded gasoline, and you'll realize that you're causing this low-level poisoning to your whole population. And there was a Surgeon General's conference, just a single day, where these things got debated, and the industry said, hey, we are totally unbiased, we're fact-driven, and if we ever find there's a problem, we'll stop doing this, but it's our responsibility to advance progress. And so what happened was they kind of ended their little conference, and a committee said, you know, we don't really have evidence that we should stop this right now, but we really have to stay on top of it. Congress should appropriate money so we can study it. Well, that never happened. The research into lead for the next 40 years was dominated by the leaded gas industry, and they ended up concluding that, you know, lead in your blood is, in fact, just a natural thing. And at one point later, they tried to argue that it was maybe a micronutrient. That argument didn't go over very well. But it wasn't until the 1960s that others came forward and said, no, we have poisoned the entire world, and now we've got this in our blood, in our brains. As you said, there were links between lead exposure and criminality, in loss of impulse control, of doing worse in school. You know, generations of people, including me, I assume, we were all affected by this.
So it wasn't General Motors that had all this power. DuPont was the developer of this leaded gas product, and then they also owned a big stake in General Motors. So it was a real wolf watching the hen house, like we have in many ways in our EPA and other areas of our government today.
And they were also partnering with Standard Oil of New Jersey, which later became Exxon, and ExxonMobil. So you had real, you know, real giants of the corporate world working together here to advance this incredibly dangerous product.
Well, it's a terrific book. I highly recommend our listeners pick it up. It's called Industrial Strength Denial, Barbara Fries. Barbara, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Samford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Curtis Mayfield and Johnny Cash.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.